May it please the court?
Yeah, let's let everybody get settled. Okay, Mr. Lieberman.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court? My name is Stephen Lieberman. I represent the appellant, Belial Garcia-Gonzalez, in this case. This appeal follows his convictions and sentence for 3 counts of sex trafficking of a minor, 7 counts related to harboring of undocumented aliens. Clearly, at trial, this evidence established, and we don't dispute, that Mr. Garcia was involved in a venture that involved the smuggling of aliens, undocumented aliens, into the United States, primarily to work at his business, the El Paraiso Bar. What the evidence is not clear, in our opinion, is whether this venture was a sex trafficking venture as the statute 1591 contemplates. And that became clear when the jury sent out a note seeking additional clarification on certain elements of the statute, and what proceeded to take place between the district court Judge Crane and the lawyers was clearly confusion on what that particular element required. The element specifically was the meaning, or they asked for clarification on the language of would be caused to engage in a commercial sex act. And the reason that they brought that up, and it was also put in their note, was because it was clear on at least one of these underage females that no sexual activity took place. So
what do you do about the language of the statute, which doesn't speak in terms of a consummated sex act, but it has language that will be caused to engage in commerce and sex act? And under the, as I understand this arrangement, these young women essentially had no means of having any income except by engaging in a sex act.
That's what the government's...
That's the government's theory of the case.
Theory, right, Judge. It's our position, though, that it's more than just whether a sex act occurred. This court has not addressed that issue straight on. What the government cites in their brief are some Ninth Circuit cases that seem to address it, although those cases are factually distinguishable from this case. And what they're saying is, yeah, it's some act in the future, but it has to be tied into what activity did the defendant do, whether it be through force, fraud, or coercion that would cause them in the future to do it, or some other action that would cause them to. What the government seems to be relying upon is, after the fact, we have these people who have no means to support themselves, so we can just take that leap and say, oh, they would engage in acts of prostitution or commercial sex acts.
I'm sorry, you didn't say that they didn't have sex acts for money, right? Because they did. The record shows that many of them did, all except the youngest person.
Two of the four underage did not, right. But the jury note was specific as to one of those who did not, count number two, I believe.
But she was touched inappropriately, the record reflects.
On that particular one, that may be correct, but I don't think the rest of the definition of commercial sex act apply. There was no testimony or evidence that was in accordance with something being a value being negotiated for that. I think what happened is they were supposed to sit with these men, drink beer with them, dance with them, and I think she testified during the course of that some men might have groped her. I don't think
she's supposed to let the men grope her. That's part of the deal.
Well, that was the government's theory, but I think the government's position was specifically that prostitution, exchanging money, something of value, that part of the statute. And as to that particular female, that did not take place. Because there was evidence about they would have to go negotiate or visit with Mr. Garcia and arrange whatever agreement, and then they would leave. That's the one who actually did, the oldest of the three.
Okay. You're not saying they chose to have these sex acts on their own without... pressure from Mr. Garcia, are you?
What I'm saying, if we're getting into now
the ones that did have sex.
The sufficiency, I'm saying, did the government prove it was through force, fraud, or coercion that they did?
He's keeping them there, and he says the only way you can earn any money is if you have sex in addition to working at my bar every night, which you only get $20 for, which you can never use to pay off your extreme debt that you owe me. So you'll never have any money, and you're going to have to stay here and work at my bar. That's not coercion under the fair reading of this record and the light most favorable to the verdict?
If That's what the evidence showed as to all of them, I would agree. As to the two oldest ones, they specifically testified that there was never a nexus between you need to do this to pay back this smuggling debt. One of them specifically, in count two, was never even had that conversation with Mr. Garcia. She admitted to that. They came through one of the other females whose house she lived in, suggested if you wanted to make some more money, you can do this. And the evidence showed Mr. Garcia was nowhere around during that period of time. He had been in Mexico for a month. What I'm getting at, I think we need to look at each count separately to assess the sufficiency of the evidence as to the elements. It's easy to lump them all together, but he was indicted on a conspiracy count of three substantive counts, and the evidence on each three differs from one to the next. But also getting back to the issue of the jury instruction, it's not just simple a matter of whether or not a sex act had to occur or not. We argue that the definition or the instruction that was given was not responsive to the jury's question, and it served to be misleading and confusing and ultimately rendering a verdict in this case. The gravamen of the statute is there needs to be some kind of commercial sexual activity involved, whether it takes place or not, and for the court to tell the jury they don't have to find that is really contrary to the statute and reduce the government's burden to prove all the elements of the offense. It was, number one, I think there was ambiguity in what the question was that we're asking, but they certainly never provided any clarification as to that element of the offense. And in fact, Judge Crane initially was inclined to say that it did require a sexual act take place until they looked at the Brooks case. But factually, the Brooks case is so far distinguishable from the instant case because in that case, we had an instant. Number one, in that case, we're dealing with people who admittedly, the defendants in those Ninth Circuit cases admittedly indicated that they were, quote, pimps, excuse my language, who would use these women as profit-producing assets. I mean, that's what the court talked about. They relied on the prostitution as a means for their income. I don't think we had that in this case. But in any event, in the Brooks case, what the court said, you didn't need to have a sex act because everything was put in place. These defendants actually advertised these services. They drove these people to hotels. They put them up in hotels and said just because the sex act didn't occur in that instance, because perhaps she was still under the influence of drugs, they found in that case you didn't have to have the sex act. But the instruction the judge gave here is confusing because they only asked that a sex act have to occur, not a commercial sex act. And the judge instructed the jury, no, a commercial sex act does not have to occur. It's our position that was confusing to the jury on because that's the gravamen of the offense. Now, this was our position to relieve the government of their burden to prove all the elements of the offense without further instructing or giving clarification as to what the term will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act. And the judge even commented it was a poorly written statute. There was a lot of confusion amongst everybody, especially the jury, and it's our position that the note was not answered properly or accurately, and it confused the jury, and it ultimately would have affected their verdict.
Is there evidence in the record that he told them how much to charge for the sex and arranged the sex meetings?
I believe on one of the females, the oldest one, there was discussion about that, something to charge a certain amount, and he would want $50. The interesting thing about that is that she testified, she kept all the money.
He told her he was going to want some a cut of that, too.
That was her testimony, but her testimony was, yeah, he would want a cut of that. But then she later testified she kept all the money, so something was inconsistent with
her
testimony.
Even all the money doesn't solve the problem. As I understand the deal was, that was the only way they could make any money for themselves, because all the other money that they made in selling $5 drink beers to and so on and so forth went to the house and then went to the debt that they had incurred by being imported.
Judge, we're certainly not arguing that these young ladies were not exploited. Our argument is, does it fit the elements of this statute? Did they know, when they were being brought over, transported, that in the future they would be caused through force, fraud, coercion to actually engage in commercial sexual activity as opposed to other ways to support themselves. Okay. I mean, the government's argument would be that, well, if they went and engaged in drug dealing to support themselves, then that makes Mr. Garcia a drug trafficker because he...
No, well, but isn't, but there's, you know, you use the term, and you apologize to the court, but you used the term pimp earlier.
Right.
So therefore, I'll use the term in the question. Once he says these are your clients, to even one of these girls, and they're all staying there together, isn't he engaged in the commercial sex act? It's not just fortuitous, or you have to say, well, they're going to have to try to find a way to support themselves. He is facilitating the commercial sex act at that point.
In light of the language in the Todd case, though, it's not so clear, because in that case, what they're talking about is specifically, they talk about a modus operandi, which was securing an income from prostitution. The appellant was not securing an income from these people prostituting themselves, if in fact that was going on. He brought these people in, unfortunately, like a lot of people, is frankly cheap labor, undocumented aliens, to work in his business. Incidental to that, the evidence showed that they did engage in this activity. But was that a modus operandi that he would
Because he told them to. He said, you need to do this, or else you'll never have any money. And by the way, if you ever try to escape when you haven't paid off all your debt, I'll hunt you down and kill you.
Well, I understand that's what their testimony was. Looking at the totality, there was also evidence that some of these individuals were able to leave and go back. So I understand what you're saying, but I'm just simply saying, applying the statute as those Ninth Circuit cases did, could he say that in the future, based on force, fraud, and coercion, these specific commercial sexual activity was going to happen and would happen? When we had two people that never engaged in that, never even left the bar, and the thing is, the jury questioned that themselves. So it wasn't like they had a question about that. So it was unclear in that
regard. Before your time lapses, you might want to address what I think an argument where you have a little more traction with the duplicity. On the alien harboring counts, I think it's 5 and 6.
I'm sorry.
The counts of duplicity.
Yes, Your Honor.
You said are duplicitous in the sentencing, and I think it's counts 5 and 6. There are 6 counts of illegal
right.
harboring, and I think it was counts 5 and 6 that essentially would punish them twice for the same act.
Correct, Your Honor. They were three of the harboring of undocumented alien counts applied to each of the 3 underage females. Same defendants involved, same time frame, same city. The only difference was one set of the 3 was they were harbored in a house in Mission, Texas. The other one that they were harbored in the bar in Mission, Texas. It's our position that it's the same offense.
Yeah. Assuming you're correct, what should this court do to correct the error?
Well, I think the sentence should be vacated and remanded for resentencing.
To the late, though, to reform a sentence only for without treating those as one. Well, being the 2, 5, and 6, not giving them separate purchase. 5 and 6 are the same.
I guess the question is, and we wouldn't know.
Weren't all these sentences concurrent?
Yeah, but they had well, as I pointed out, the case of citing
you just vacate. If they're concurrent sentences, would you get full relief simply by vacating one of the counts?
Well, there would have to be a new judgment because they got a special assessment. They received a special assessment for each of those extra counts, and the cases I cite in the brief indicate that would be a basis for vacating the judgment, at least issuing a new judgment. What we don't know is what effect it would have on the ultimate sentence. Judge Crane, on how many counts he was putting in, when he came up with his sentence, he was obviously considering all the factors involved, and we don't know if that would have affected the outcome of this sentence because he sentenced at the low end of the guidelines based on all those.
But you have to show that this offends the dignity of our court, that they had to pay $200 extra in order to prevail, because you have to meet prong 4, all the prongs of plain error to prevail on that claim, don't you?
I do, Your Honor.
And it's just $200 difference, isn't it?
That's $300.
$300.
That's correct.
I'm trying to get at the practicalities of it in terms of trying to, if you're correct in that, the best way to get quick and clean relief without necessity reforming and bringing everybody back and resentencing.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor.
Where are these defendants now? He's
incarcerated in federal prison.
Where?
Where physically is he? I believe he's in a prison in California, federal prison in California.
Yeah, so you have to bring him back from California to go through a ritual of just doing nothing to the sentence but vacating one. I'm trying to get up
the. I understand you're addressing the practicality of it. I'm looking from the standpoint of do we know how that would ultimately impact Judge Crane in resentencing the case? I don't know, and that's why if we vacated the sentence and sent it back.
Sure we know, but good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Lieberman. Ms. Lambos?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Demetra Lambros for the United States. The evidence on all three counts with these young sisters overwhelmingly proved that Mr. Garcia was guilty of sex trafficking under Section 1591. On the one daughter, the 14-year-old, who came later, who didn't have sex before they were caught, that does not mean that he did not violate the statute. The statute does not require that a victim actually have to engage in prostitution in order to be guilty. What the statute requires is that the defendant recruit, harbor, or transport a victim knowing that she will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act. And as the Ninth Circuit, which is the only one that has dealt with this issue, has found, the mens rea requirement is only that he has to know that some plan or modus operandi would be in place that would cause the victim to engage in commercial sex. And here, that's clearly satisfied with regard to the one young girl, the 14-year-old, who didn't have sex. His plan and his modus operandi, as Judge Elrod said, was to coerce these girls. He brought them here, he pressed them to work in his bar, he dressed them in provocative clothes, he had them drink and dance with his customers, and then he told them, look, the only way that you will ever have any money is if you have sex with my customers. That is classic coercion under the statute. And it was proved as to all three of the girls. Not only he explicitly told the 14-year-old angrily, when one customer gave him $300 to have sex with her and she said no, he said, look, only if you have sex with my customers are you ever going to have any money. Classic coercion. With the first daughter, too, the older daughter, she had sex 6 times every time he did the arranging with her. And they all testified, the only reason that we're having sex with these customers is because we're not being given any money. Classic coercion. On the question of multiplicity, the defendant cannot survive plain error review on the question of the multiplicity. Whether the statute creates one or two offenses really does boil down to a question of statutory construction. And that's a question of whether how Congress defined the relevant unit of prosecution. And here, the statute, the alien harboring statute, makes it a crime to harbor an illegal alien in any place or in any building. And it goes on to say that a person who violates the statute shall be punished for each alien in respect to whom such a violation occurs. At the very least, that unit of prosecution is unclear. It could be, I think as Judge Chisholm-Bockham may think, that it is just, one alien and any harboring of that alien at any place.
Let me ask you this. There's always this conceptual awkwardness about plain error and rule of lenity.
Yes.
And why isn't this answered strictly by the rule of lenity? That, yes, resolving this uncertainty in the favor of the defendant, the accused in the criminal matter, charged the actus reus here is simply the unit of prosecution. There's one unit of prosecution that contained, and 5 and 6 are part of that same unit. They're not separate units of prosecution. Why wouldn't the rule of lenity take us there?
The rule of lenity does, as you say, apply to say when there is ambiguity, we should look to the most narrow construction of the statute to find only one offense. But that principle only applies in the case of a preserved challenge, when the defendant is before the district court saying, hey, don't sentence me twice to for one offense. Otherwise, there would be no difference between a preserved claim and an ambiguous and a forfeited claim under plain error.
What case do you have that says that that demands that the rule of lenity not be antecedent to the plain error inquiry?
I don't have a case that says that the rule of lenity that is deciding that question, that the ambiguity of the rule of lenity says that we don't, that the ambiguity applies to show that it's not clear or obvious. However, a number of cases that are cited on page 53 of the government's brief says that where there is ambiguity in the unit of prosecution, the government, the defendant cannot establish plain error. Because again, if it's ambiguous, the unit of prosecution.
But what do you do to the counter argument that the question threshold is exactly whether there's one or two, whether what is under the statute the criminalized conduct? And in resolving that, the rule of lenity says there's only one criminal act here. So that's established. Now the question is there ask the question of plain error, and there is no error then to talk about. In other words, it's not a question of appellate review. You might have appellate review of the threshold question, I suppose, but whether lenity resolved the problem. But lenity obtained regardless. It seems to me that because it isn't, the argument goes, because it's premised upon basic due process notions of fairness and vagueness, and which only Congress can answer. And they can define what criminal conduct is.
Well, but this court has never decided what the unit of prosecution is. I hear what you're saying. I think that it is also the case that because the statute does not say it's a crime to harbor an alien, period. It says it's a crime to harbor an alien in any place or in any building. So a very fair reading of the statute would be that the harboring at any place or any building is the unit of prosecution. And when the defendant does not make any kind of argument to the district court, and this court, and no court as far as I have seen, has ever decided what the unit of prosecution is, plain error review means nothing. If, in fact, what would happen is you all were to decide on your own that the ambiguity means that, or any ambiguity would mean that the defendant gets relief under this circumstance.
But so you could find that we're going to do one alien, one place, if we were to make that rule as the first court, since we're considering that issue. That would be prong one. In prong two, we could... It would not necessarily be clear because it had never been said before, and it's novel.
Yes.
It might or may or not. But then prong three, the substantial rights are affected by the $300 under our precedent, right?
That's right.
And then prong four, does it offend justice that they would pay $300 for something that was, you know, not raised?
Yes.
That's the issue.
Yes.
If we were to find plain error here, though, could we reform the judgment to delete those duplicative, those extra claims and reform the take away the $300 special assessment?
What I think you could do is you could remand to the district court
to
vacate one of the two judgments and to then enter judgment only on one of the counts per each.
Do we have the power to do that without resentencing?
A resentencing is not required here because none of these calculations would have affected the guidelines range. The district court, as Judge Higginbotham said, sentenced him to concurrent terms of imprisonment. And so really the only issue here is the $100 on each count, and that could be done with a remand and an order to vacate one of each. But again, I don't think you have to even go there because I think you can find that he hasn't satisfied plain error and can actually affirm it as it is. And unless the...
Well, the question, if you ask the question first, is it plain? And the answer to the question of plainness You say, we know it's not plain because it's uncertain.
Yeah.
This is one of those.
It is a difficult brain teaser, yes.
But that only is if you ignore the fundamental principle that under the rule of lenity, it is plain. I mean, it is clear error. Now, whether you thereafter survive plain error on the is a different
question, but I also think at the threshold you asked to ask, is there an error? And I think there's actually a pretty fair answer that it's not an error. But
I understand.
Unless you all have any questions about the sentence or any other concerns. Right.
Thank you, Ms. Lambert.
Thank you.
Mr. Lieberman, you save time for rebuttal.
Yes, briefly, Your Honor. During my initial argument, I was searching for the case, but the case I cited in my brief is the OBGA case, which addresses, not in the context of smuggling, harboring of aliens, but the issue of plain error when it comes to multiplicitous convictions. And in that case, the court indicated that sentences with special assessments imposed for individual counts are not, in fact, concurrent, no matter how small the special assessments. And in finding that it implicated the double jeopardy clause, they found it met all the prongs of the plain air review. And in that case, they remanded it back to the court for resentencing. And I believe that was an opinion that was offered by you, Judge Higginbotham. So I'm just saying that I was trying to think of the name of the case I was arguing before. It was in my brief, but that's the case that I was relying upon to say plain error has been met and the case should be remanded for resentencing. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lieberman. Your case is under submission and the court